KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories, even if the segues get weird. my co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
I just want to mention in passing that yesterday was December 7th. Mm. You may know that, but for those who don't know or recall, that was the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. As Abraham Lincoln said in his Gettysburg Address, the world will little note nor long remember. And as generations pass, so it will always be. Okay, next item. Do remember that there is a runoff election coming up this Saturday. Early voting ended yesterday. Election day is December 11th, Saturday. You can go to harrisvotes.com to find your polling place. If you're not in Harris County, you can look at the show post, which always yes. has access to various election.
County clerk's offices, election administrator's offices. I want to mention, saw this ahead of time, this mention of the election, and thought to check the Brazoria County clerk's office for where I live. And the election page on that website has not been updated since the November election of this year. So it seems, I'm thinking from that we're not having an election on Saturday. So make sure that you go to your county government website and make sure that there is or is not an election in your county, because you don't want to drive to your local polling place and find that there's no polling set up or something like that.
Also keep in mind that there may be runoff elections in your county, but not in your very specific precinct. So for example, like in my precinct, there's only one race. It's on the Board of Ed, whatever they call it in the county. And it's just that one race. And it's in my particular group of precincts. So this is very location specific. So do check for yourself. Mm-hmm. But good point, Andrew.
Thank you.
Okay. This is actually from yesterday, from click2houston.com. Residents in Siena neighborhood plead for help from their HOA with a feral hog invasion. Homeowners want the HOA to help protect their property. Now, this neighborhood is near Missouri City in Fort Bend County and apparently has an ongoing issue with feral hogs. Teresa Hanna lives in Siena, where sightings of feral hogs are not new, and neither is the damage they've been known to cause. Her neighbors have had the same problem. This time, Hannah said she wanted a more permanent solution and she wanted Siena's HOA to help her develop one. Hannah said her representative in the community's front office told her not much could be done because the hogs are wild and invasive. Sandra Denton is the general manager of Siena Associations and said the levees and rivers that wind through Fort Bend County pave a prime path for porkers. The writer obviously liked alliteration. There was much more of it in this article that I cut out. She said the hog population seems to be a bit higher this year than we've seen in the past. Denton said Siena offers recommendations for residents, but the hogs are wild, invasive, and according to Denton, not within Siena's ability to remove. She said also, we always share that they can treat their yard to get rid of the grubs, and there are certain chemicals and treatments available. So apparently, the hogs are grubbing for grubs.
Mm.
But, I mean, that's not all they grub for. So I'm not sure that just getting rid of the grubs is going to be a solution. But, yeah. Hey, at least the HOA is offering something. Andrew?
Well, I mean, what the questions that I have from the article are, how do the hogs and the grubs that they're after impact the ecosystem? Would the ecosystem in the area be harmed if they were gone? Now, it mentions that the hogs are invasive, so that suggests that they're not supposed to be there. They were introduced by humans.
They're European originally, and they were brought over to breed with domestic hogs. And blah,
okay.
Blah, blah.
So you know, because they're an invasive species, there may be an ecological argument for, you know, letting them die out or hunting them or something like that. And what's the environmental impact of the CNS suggested degrubbing techniques? Because I would think that the grubs the hogs are after would be native to the area. I would think.
Maybe. Hard to say.
I suppose. It's possible that they're not.
Now, as far as hunting, I have previously read that because feral hogs are an invasive species, there is no season on them.
Mm.
You don't need a license to hunt them. But of course, you need to be in areas where hunting is legal. So, for example, in this community, I wouldn't be discharging firearms trying to kill hogs.
That's true. And you also need to have people who think it's worth hunting them. You also need to have an ability to actually hunt them. People with that, you know, the firearms and the traps that are necessary. And so it's not as simple as saying declaring open season and, you know, considering the problem dealt with. But it is worth sort of asking, are there other measures that could be taken that might be more effective, and what impact those measures would have on the ecosystem? Because obviously it's a nuisance for the homeowners, and I totally get
it. Oh, it's not just the nuisance. These animals are dangerous, and they're huge.
Yes.
They can run upwards of 400 pounds. But now here's a thought. Mm-hmm. What if there is one hog that becomes the equivalent of the Hunchback of Notre Dame and decides living in heavily populated communities represent a form of sanctuary where they cannot be hunted? If they get wise to this idea, these people are screwed, and I guess a lot of other communities as well. So
that's an idea.
It is an idea if you happen to be a feral hog. Don't share. Okay, this article is from HoustonChronicle.com. It's a nightmare. Residents demand repairs, pest control at complex for people with mental health needs. This is from about a week ago, but no further update that I found. In the 14-unit Acres Home Garden Apartments, toilets will not flush, lights will not turn on, and cockroach nymphs, not as adorable as it sounds when it's a cockroach, scamper across walls, counters, and floors. In at least one unit, tenants say the ceiling still is damaged from a pipe that burst in February's freeze. In another, the residents say water seeps under the front door onto the living room floor whenever it rains. On November 21st, tenants delivered a letter to the Housing Corporation of Greater Houston, a nonprofit that develops and manages low-income housing in Houston. Their demands included adequate repairs and maintenance carried out in a timely manner and control of pests and rodents. The Houston Housing Management Corporation, the subsidiary of the Housing Corporation that manages the property, responded the next day with an offer to discuss the demands on that Tuesday morning. According to Bill Haley, Housing Corporation's executive director, in an email, the Houston Housing Management Corporation has timely responded to all requests for repairs. The demands in the letter entail mostly maintenance items that are in process or repairs that are being bid on by contractors, he said, adding that the property manager plans to complete the repairs as soon as possible. There are not many apartment complexes that specialize in serving people with mental illnesses, and the units at Acres Home Garden Apartments are subsidized, so tenants spend no more than 30% of their incomes on rent. As a result, many say tenants do not feel they have the option of moving. Kent Churchill moved into Acres Home Gardens apartments in 2014. He was drawn by the idea of housing that could afford him stability and independence, especially after living in a personal care home, which he found unstimulating. He said, "I like this place because it's independent. You can come and go as you please," which is a comment in itself. Mm. And for the first few years, he said, it was very good. In recent years, however, Churchill and others said their repair requests have gone unanswered. And do remember, my stories typically are very, very excerpted. There is more. Together, Churchill and neighbor Richard Caudill decided to contact the Houston Tenants Union, an organization that coaches tenants on how to place pressure on landlords to make changes such as repairs. A few months later, they and other tenants delivered their demand letter. Housing conditions need to be safe and they need to be secure. And when those conditions are not met, that's something that needs addressing, said Caleb Miller, the organizer at the Houston Tenants Union, who is advising tenants at Acres Homes Garden Apartments. He went on, "These are issues tenants face all over the city, all over the country. We're an organization that believes that building tenant power is the best way to combat these issues." So, I mean, I think that Andrew and I have kind of predictable stances on this, more or less. There's a Venn diagram where we have agreement. Mm-hmm. And I think where we'll agree is that if you're going to pay rent, mm-hmm. which is a nod to Andrew, then you should have a landlord who is both willing and able to do repairs.
Yes.
Doing repairs requires money. Mm-hmm. Money comes from rent and or state or federal or local subsidies. So, I mean, the mix has to be right. You can't just ignore tenants that have significant, and I'm going to use that term advisedly, significant maintenance or health or safety needs. Mm-hmm. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, the entire first half of this article, I was thinking, this is something that the Houston Tenants Union would really would really help with, I think. And then lo and behold, in the latter half of the article, there they show up. So, but I, you know, I love to see the HTU in action. I put a link in my show notes on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com to the Houston Tenants Union website for anybody who wants that link. I hope the Acres tenants get all their demands met, and I hope that this inspires tenants in other complexes to start organizing too.
And, you know, the caveat I'll put in there is, I guess, like any company that's not excited to have a union, mm-hmm. I guess my comment might be, don't earn the need for one.
Yeah, true. You know, if, you know, I think that even in good jobs where unions are more common, unions still benefit, but they're more precautionary. Or workers still benefit from a union presence, but it's more precautionary in case things take a turn for the worse. So it's not a bad idea.
Policy.
Exactly. It's not a bad idea to have one in the back pocket. But if you can be a good employer, if you can, you know, have, if you can treat your people with respect and pay them fairly and, you know, and give them adequate benefits, then your life will probably be easier as an employer. So
basically it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Okay. Next story from Houston Chronicle. Also, it's about a week old. Unconventional Houston shelter signals shift in housing reform to include expertise of formerly homeless. At the Life Center in Independence Heights, the formerly homeless run an unconventional transitional living facility. It doesn't require people to spend certain hours in the building, nor does it push them to graduate until they found permanent housing. What's more, it's staffed by people who have been through Life Center services themselves, people who turn the hardest experiences of their lives into a valuable asset not many share. The value of that hard-earned perspective, called testimony at the Life Center and lived experience in other groups addressing homelessness, has gained traction in recent years. Increasingly, nonprofits and government groups are seeking the advice of people with lived experience as they make plans for addressing homelessness. The Coalition of the Homeless in Houston and Harris County lists two consumer representatives on its steering committee. Said the National Coalition for the Homeless in a report on homeless leadership, "The only chance we have for truly ending homelessness lies in the expertise and leadership of those who have been impacted most by the experience of homelessness," which makes perfect sense. While the importance of lived experience is gaining traction, Ava Thibodeau-Gratchik, head of the permanent supportive housing provider Temenos Community Development Corp., said the best models have a blend of staff with lived experience and supportive staff. The supportive staff can then work to meet the emotional, mental health, and professional needs of the staff with lived experience. She also worried about the Life Center working outside of the Houston area's homeless response system, the Way Home, a portal that assesses residents and works to match them with housing. Life Center staff were hesitant about becoming part of Houston's homeless response team, uncertain of how complicated or burdensome the membership would be. But Thibodeau Gratchik said that such a system helps protect residents and connect them to further resources. She went on, part of being part of the system is you're held to certain standards about how you operate and how you treat residents. The system is also used to connect people such as the population served by the Life Center with permanent supportive housing. Yeah, this notion of graduating out of shelters, you know, it's kind of like aging out of foster homes.
Yeah.
I mean, I get the concept from a fiscal state perspective, but it's ridiculous to think that on someone's birthday they get evicted.
Yeah.
And it's kind of ridiculous to think that someone who has had a long-term homelessness problem will at some arbitrary point graduate out of homelessness.
Yeah.
It's obviously going to be a lot more individualized than that, Andrew.
Yeah. And in both of those instances, people who haven't gone through those experiences would have most likely a support network of parents or of, you know, still having a home, you know.
And a certain amount of dumb luck doesn't hurt either.
Yeah. And so these sorts of this sort of idea of bringing people in who have already been through the assistance programs. Yeah. Sort of steps in for that support network because you can sort of go back and still, you know, be involved with something. It's not an entire replacement, but it's I think it's something. As I said last show, people in a system, I think, are the best ones to lead it. I said it last week or last show in the frame of the foster system, but I think it also goes for houseless support. As for the Life Center not joining Way Home, I'm actually part of a group that has been invited into a coalition of other community groups for disaster support before. And we haven't joined because the coalition's expectations of us aren't really figured out yet. I think that if the Life Center is in a similar position, I think it's fair for them to hold off on joining Way Home until they have a better idea of what they'd be expected to do. With that said, there is something to be said for having them held to a certain standard on how to treat people, because as we've seen with the Salvation Army, faith-based organizations like the Life Center, Christian faith-based organizations like the Life Center, don't always treat people equitably and fairly. So,
well, to be fair, it isn't just a matter of religiously based, and forgive me for cutting you off, but we have other stories to do, but, you know, it's not just religiously based organizations that sometimes use and abuse people that they're supposed to be helping, even when they actually think they're helping them.
True.
You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org, podcast it, which is my recommendation on your phone's podcast app, or you can go to archive.kpft.org and not only listen to past Think Wing shows, but also other shows from KPFT, from FM, HD2, etc. Every story that we read on this show is typically very heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just go to the show post page. You can either click on the most recent show or you can do a search in the search window for previous shows using keywords or terms or things of that nature. Also, we are on social media. You can find me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. You can find me on, or us rather, I should say, on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio. And you can also, of course, go to thinkwingradio.com where I've got literally about 11 years of stuff.
Mm.
No shortage. You can binge. And yeah. Andrew?
Yes, I also have my own social accounts. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Our next story is from KHOU.com from the 29th. How much are Houston area schools spending to help kids who have fallen behind? Learning loss has accelerated dramatically during the COVID-19 pandemic, but schools and districts across Houston vary widely on how much they're spending towards catching students up who have fallen behind. A KHOU 11 News analysis of grant applications for the latest round of Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief, or ESSER III funds, reveals that more than $1.8 billion has been allocated to 94 local education agencies, which are charter schools and school districts in the greater Houston area. Under the federal rules, those educational entities must set aside at least 20% to programs that address learning loss. Those may include high dosage tutoring, hiring specialized interventionists, and expanding summer school opportunities. The remaining money may be spent on everything from HEPA filters and other pandemic-related safety improvements to capital expenditures. Turns out, 34 districts and charter schools in the Houston area are only dedicating the 20% minimum, according to their applications. On the flip side, 18 have promised to use 66% or more for learning loss mitigation. Goose Creek ISD, which is all in, the Baytown district is spending 100% of ESSER III funding toward catching kids up. A large chunk of the federal grant money is paying retired teachers to come back to school for intensive one-on-one and small group tutoring sessions. None of the major districts that listed 20% for learning loss on their grant applications agreed to an interview, except for Humble ISD. According to the Humble superintendent, Dr. Elizabeth Fagan, it's appropriate if you're using other dollars to support your students and make sure that they are being successful. Fagan said the district decided to dedicate more state funding toward learning loss, which are recurring dollars, not short-term one-and-done money. She said the federal dollars will ultimately run out. As part of an annual budget going forward, Humble ISD hired 50 teachers to double staff in some at-risk elementary classrooms identified by data and metrics. Students who have fallen behind the most now have two teachers instead of one. According to Fagan, quote, we bring those teacher-student ratios from 1 to 20, which is a more difficult scenario to personalize learning, to a ratio of 1 to 10. And along with the story link, I've also linked to a video and an interactive graphics that are in that story. Hmm. You know, one of the things that we occasionally talk about that we'll touch on a little bit more later in the show is that the time you live in can end up having a profound impact on your life going forward. Mm. People that lived through the Depression never forgot it. It affected the way they saved, the way they spent, what they bought, what they saved, even to some extent, what they hoarded. You know, the era we're going through now with the pandemic, it will probably have long-term effects because of impacts on young social lives, romantic experience, dating experience, educational experience. I mean, there's no way to even predict what the lifetime consequences will be of people that have lived through this pandemic period.
Yeah.
So whatever you can do to try to mitigate those learning losses is critically important, especially in the younger children. I mean, not to say that the older kids don't matter, but the younger children are much more heavily influenced by that kind of loss and trauma. Andrew?
Yeah, on your point about how the pandemic is going to affect young people's lives going forward, I saw a joke online talking about how when we're all grandparents, we'll be telling our grandkids, you should put down that hollow 3D thingamajig, because when I was your age, we couldn't go outside for an entire year, you know? But it's a good point. You know, this is going to have some effects that we can't really predict with a whole lot of accuracy yet. We will just have to see what kind of social changes this inspires. In reference to the actual spending, depending on district size, 20% of the ESSER funds may actually be more than enough to catch students up, I think. In my opinion, a better angle for this story would have been what districts are doing to catch up students, not how much they're spending on it. Because it's all well and good to spend $100,000 on catching kids up, but if it goes to a grifter who shows up, talks at students for an hour, and leaves, it's no better than only spending enough to catch 2 of every 10 students up.
Well, I think that's a different story. That Maybe. Would be investigative journalism. I think also you're talking about the difference, say, between Harris County and Crockett County, because there's going to be a vast difference in terms of the resources available, and one and done may be the best they can do. Also, I want to point out, as far as trauma, I mean, we're talking about a 13-year period where probably a couple of generations are being traumatized by the 2008 financial crash, Trump, and the pandemic.
Well, and the aftermath of 9/11, the security and
that goes back another half a generation. But I'm talking between 2008 and now, that 13-year period. You can talk about the whole generational period, you know, from 2001. But I'm just thinking, within 13 years, think of how many age cohorts are affected by that. The 9/11 catastrophe, I mean, those people now are already adults living their experience. And, you know, I talked about Pearl Harbor, how it's going to be forgotten as time passes. It's not like we celebrate Fort Sumter anniversaries or the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne in Sarajevo. I mean, we don't talk about that much anymore. And Pearl Harbor is going to fade like that also. This generation, it's 9/11. It's their Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think that when we talk about the effects of Pearl Harbor of 9/11, I talk more about the security implications, the increased spending on war, you know, these sorts of the social and cultural changes, rather than the actual immediate impact on the deaths of on the families of the people who died. But I think that you're right in that eventually every historical event becomes, you know, relegated to the history books. You know, it happens because we can only hold so much in our personal memories. We can only hold so much in our generational memories. So,
yeah. And, you know, the more time that goes on, the more history there is to learn and forget.
Yep.
Okay. I have a one sentence story. As holidays arrive, more than 55% of Texans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. This is as reported by Texas Tribune staff. I just want to make the point, yay?
Yeah. I mean,
well, 55%, let's think about this. 55% represents most of self-identified Democrats and a small number of self-identified Republicans. Just kind of funny.
Yeah, I think it's important to note these people are now protected against the more severe symptoms or effects of COVID-19. The preventing spreading it is still going to be about wearing masks and keeping social distance. So
and
make
hand
sure
washing.
You're still doing
Let's
that.
Not forget hand washing. Too many people
hand washing. Yeah.
Hand washing.
Yeah. True.
Okay. This is from December 6th from communityimpact.com. Ground breaks on Shepherd Drive, Durham Drive improvement project in the Heights. Ground breaks, technically, it's a shovel full. Although an actual groundbreaking is not expected to take place until January, a ceremonial shovel was put into the ground December 4th for a project that will transform Shepherd and Durham Drives in the Houston Heights over the next 5 years. We've talked about this actually previously on the show. The redevelopment project, which spans roughly 5 miles from the northern segment of Loop 610 to I-10 West, will reduce the number of traffic lanes on each road from 4 to 3 while adding protected bike lanes and installing sidewalks. The roads being redeveloped date back to the 1950s. In addition to the lane reduction, the project also includes installing new traffic signals, crosswalk striping, new signal timing to reduce congestion and crashes, the repositioning of some bus stops, protected bike lanes, wider sidewalks, more trees, and the replacement of underground water and sewer infrastructure while the road is being redone. Citing a 2019 study, Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner said the project will reduce common vehicle crashes by 50%, pedestrian crashes by 67%, and bicycle crashes by 38%. Construction is expected to begin in January on phase one, and construction on phase two could start in 2023. The overall project is expected to be ongoing for 5 to 6 years. As an aside, I've driven on Sheppard and Durham in that section that they're going to be redeveloping. And while it sounds horrible for drivers to cut a road from four lanes back to three, it's like counterintuitive. But having driven that road, I will tell you that the edges of each road are so broken up that people don't much use them if they can avoid it anyway. So I don't think it's going to make a huge difference in terms of increasing congestion, and the increased quality of the road may, in fact, improve traffic flow, as they say. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2 Houston. KPFT is Houston's community station, which means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage, hit the donate button, pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, which can be large, small, or in between. We appreciate all of it. You could also perhaps qualify for a lovely thank you gift. You can also donate by texting the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. And you can also spread the word because, you know, word of mouth is free and helps. Okay, going back to road improvements and the connection between cities trying to figure this stuff out. There's a story in FastCompany.com. 40% of San Francisco's traffic deaths are from left turns. These design fixes could change that. The city is dramatically rethinking its intersections to make dangerous left turns a thing of the past. Drivers turning left are responsible for a disturbingly high proportion of pedestrian injuries and deaths in the city of San Francisco. Solving the problem could be a matter of design. The scope of the problem became evident in 2018 when the San Francisco Department of Public Health analyzed 5 years' worth of left turn crash data. The agency then teamed up with the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency to better understand why so many deaths were happening in left turn situations. What they found was a mix of design issues and common driver behaviors that unnecessarily put pedestrians at risk. To address both these problems, the SFMTA launched the Safer Intersections Project to test out new approaches to intersection design, as well as a $2 million grant-funded public education campaign aimed at reducing unsafe driving. The effort is part of the city's Vision Zero plan, which aims to eliminate traffic-related deaths. On the design side, the agency found that part of the reason left turns are so dangerous is that drivers are often going too fast and turning too tight of an angle to properly see whether a pedestrian might be crossing the street. I might also add sometimes they're racing against oncoming traffic. The intersection retrofits are aimed at changing the way drivers navigate during left turns and include the placement of vertical posts partly inside intersections, as well as 6-foot rubber speed bumps that extend the center line of travel lanes and large painted zones that show drivers where not to drive. These physical elements force drivers to slow down and make more of a right angle turn through the intersection as opposed to a fast swooping curve. By making it harder to turn quickly, drivers have more time to see people crossing the road. Kind of like chickens. I don't know why I thought of that. The design interventions were installed at 7 intersections in San Francisco last fall. After a year of monitoring, SFMTA has found that the altered intersections have had significant impacts on the speed and safety of left turns. The interventions reduced the average speed at which drivers make left turns by 17% and brought a 71% reduction in drivers taking turns faster than 15 miles per hour. San Francisco's improved left turns are more than an experiment. These kinds of street engineering changes have been implemented in other cities, including Washington, D.C., New York, and Portland, Oregon, and Oregon, I should say, so that people don't get mad at me. And studies in those cities have shown similar reductions in speed during turns. SFMTA is now in the process of determining where else these interventions can be put in place across San Francisco. Its Vision Zero plan calls for interventions to be installed in 35 additional intersections. So this kind of correlates to what they're doing on Sheppard and Durham, basically trying to make design changes that not only facilitate traffic going smoothly, but also protecting pedestrians as well as other cars and drivers and animals and cyclists, etc. That just education and design can go a long way toward preventing accidents, much like safety improvements in cars themselves have dramatically reduced fatalities and accidents. Andrew?
Yeah, what struck me about, you know, after reading this article was, I wonder if San Francisco has the unprotected flashing arrow left turn, or if all left turns in San Francisco and perhaps in California are protected. Because I had a car accident, as you know, Mike, and a few, a year, two, geez, how long has it been now?
Yeah, the older you get, the faster it goes.
And, you know, we have been stuck inside for a year. Anyway, my car accident happened at a flashing arrow left turn at a busy intersection where I couldn't see if a car was coming.
Were you turning or were you going
straight? I was turning. I was turning. If my turn had been protected, the oncoming traffic that I couldn't see would have had to stop and the accident would not have happened. You know, I think, and you mentioned this while you were reading the article, I think most people take left turns fast because they have to time it between oncoming cars. Yep. You know,
it's a factor.
Some people have to race them. Other people like me just aren't entirely confident about their sense of timing and probably never will be. And so we just kind of go and hope for the best, you know?
Well, remembering driving at your age, my first observation would be if you don't think you can see oncoming traffic well, the solution is not to go faster, it's to stop. And believe it or not, I had to learn that lesson the same way you did.
Yeah.
Just so you know, I'm not pointing fingers.
Mm-hmm. I think that in general, making all of the left turns at intersections that have lights protected, as in you can only go when you have a green arrow and the oncoming traffic has to stop, because some people may not know that. I think that would significantly reduce the amount of people who take these left turns at a high speed. And, you know, that has those safety benefits for pedestrians, but it also, I think, would reduce the chances of, you know, cars crashing into each other in situations like mine.
Okay, next story is from the Texas Tribune. As critical race theory and mask mandate debates heat up, Texas GOP takes aim at local school board and municipal races. The Republican Party of Texas announced Monday it had launched a new local government committee to work with county parties on backing candidates for nominally nonpartisan local offices. The state Republican Party decided to form this group to work with county parties on backing candidates in nominally nonpartisan local elections, where issues like mask mandates and the teaching of what some conservatives call critical race theory of what some conservatives call it. That's what it's called. It's called critical race theory. And conservatives just make it, kind of
conservatives. Like conservatives misunderstand what it is. That's the what it should have said.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. The state Democratic Party has been supporting local nonpartisan candidates through a program called Project Lift that started in 2015. The program, which stands for Local Investment in the Future of Texas, recruits, trains, and provides resources to people running for municipal offices and school boards. My feeling is we shouldn't have nonpartisan municipal elections. It sounds great in theory, but it's almost like false advertising. You know, truth in advertising is, you know which party this person's aligned with, you know which party that person's aligned with, and if you know nothing else, it gives you an idea philosophically of where the parties are. And of course, in your case, the Green Party. Mm-hmm. Andrew?
Yeah, honestly, I think you've said everything that needs to be said here. I totally agree. You know, nonpartisan races aren't really nonpartisan, so why present them as such?
Yeah, nominally, I think, is the key word. Okay, click to Houston. We're very heavy in local news these days. Click2Houston.com. Federal officials are now investigating the I-45 expansion project. In the heart of Houston's Greater Fifth Ward is Bruce Elementary, its future in jeopardy, according to critics of the I-45 expansion project, if the plans to redesign and expand I-45 from downtown Houston to Greens Point to Beltway 8 don't get a second look. We just want fairness, said U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee. We want the best quality transportation we can get, safe and secure, but respectful of long-term residents. Congresswoman Jackson Lee said she believes TxDOT's current design unfairly targets historic neighborhoods and communities of color that are home to public housing. The federal government is now investigating whether the project violates civil rights. While most of the project is largely still on pause, last week limited work was allowed to continue after being halted for 9 months. Jackson Lee said this won't end the federal investigation. We've actually talked about this, I think, several times in different contexts about not only the I-45 expansion project, but also about how prior highway projects and expansion projects were tilted toward more affluent, more influential areas, whether because they vote more or they have more money, and against tilted against less affluent areas, areas that didn't have as much political clout.
Yeah.
So this is part of an ongoing story where going forward, it looks like, and we are hoping that we will do better.
Andrew? Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and it's worth mentioning that highways have explicitly played a role in segregation and redlining and these sorts of discriminatory practices. So there's definitely, you know, if you don't know the history, if you're not familiar with it, it may initially seem a bit ridiculous to be launching a civil rights investigation into a highway.
Hey, but I had to learn it. It was new to me.
Yeah. When you know the history, when you know how, you know, these kinds of big developments have been weaponized against communities of color, it makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, definitely cause for investigation.
Okay. Next is kind of a story, kind of a commentary. I kind of got the notion for this from a Fox News story. So I call this Bob Dole, A Legacy in Shades of Gray. And I'm going to start off with a famous quote. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Not a Shakespearean actor. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The right has freaked out over a tweet by MSNBC's Mehdi Hasan. And the Fox News article is, MSNBC anchor appears to downplay Bob Dole's accomplishments after his death because of his support for Trump. And the story in brief says, progressive NBC anchor Mehdi Hasan posted, and they didn't link to the post, what many consider to be an inappropriate dig on former presidential candidate Bob Dole's passing. The New York Times highlighted Dole's military and public service in a tweet announcing his passing, but Hasan used the tweet to also highlight Dole's support of President Trump. Bob Dole, Hasan tweeted, who endorsed and voted for Trump twice and called himself a Trumper as recently as July, has passed away, and I have linked to the tweet. Critics called out Hasan for what they took to be an unnecessary comment on the day of Dole's passing. American conservative magazine contributing editor Sohrab Amari tweeted, Mehdi Hasan, who has said non-Muslims are like animals, asterisk, has once more beckoned himself on Twitter.com, asterisk. Actual thing Hasan has said, look it up. So I looked it up. And because we're on radio, you can't see the references in Fox News that are asterisked as if there is a footnote, but there is not, nor is there a link. This is what Hasan said, as cited in an article in The Atlantic on January 19, 2021, quote, MSNBC's Mehdi Hasan argues that we should think of Trump's followers as if they were al-Qaeda, members who move freely among us because they are white rather than brown and Muslim. The article then has a further comment. The former DHS official Juliet Kayyem agrees that we should treat MAGA as a terrorist movement and Trump as its Osama bin Laden. So I also looked up the non-Muslims are like animals, quote. If it exists in that form, I couldn't find it, except as repeated in other conservative and right-wing articles and posts. Many conservatives like to refer to liberals as snowflakes who are easily riled up. These conservatives should look in a mirror, and they should not be riling up other conservatives by lying about what liberals and progressives say. Another lesson we might all take perhaps is this. No one is pure. And all of us live our lives in shades of gray. So let it be with Caesar. Andrew?
Well, you know, I don't want to disparage your producer skills. and of course,
about to.
And of course, this is your show. Your name is on the tin. But I honestly don't think of this as news. I don't see why it's, you know, being published. I don't see why we're really discussing it other than to remake points we've already made, which, fair enough for people who haven't heard them, but we could kind of do that without all of this fluff, I think, because what this story really is, as it is at its core, is people on Twitter arguing with each other. And
well, I'm going to interrupt for a moment because, you know, I am the producer and my show's my name is in the title. Yeah. But I mean, to me, what this basically was a commentary. Mm-hmm. It was a commentary that was provoked by an article on Fox News. And I wanted to put it in the context that I saw it in. So I think it's that simple.
Yeah, I mean, and again, your show, you have that right. But there are sometimes articles, items that we put on the docket for this show that I really have to try hard to find anything to say about. And
yet here we are still discussing it.
I know. If I hadn't gone this direction, I would have had nothing to say. So, you know.
Well, you know, maybe we'll edit something out. We'll see.
Who knows?
Who knows? You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, sometimes really heavily excerpted, which is why I recommend that if you find a story interesting, you can go to thinkwingradio.com. You can find the show among my blog posts and click on it and find the full story. And we've got stuff going back to like 2010 from before I was on KPFT. Also, we have social media. I am on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Also, we are on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio. And, of course, thinkwingradio.com is the website. And Andrew?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and on Tumblr spelled the same at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Next story from the Washington Post. Not exactly an obscure story. House approves $768 billion defense bill with strong support, despite some discord among Democrats. I wouldn't mention the story, except I was curious what the discord was about. So I found this piece. Several key policy provisions that had won clear majority support in Congress, including to more broadly change the military justice system, require women to register with Selective Service, and repeal the Iraq War Authorization, were discarded as lawmakers in the House and Senate raced to strike a compromise on the measure that dictates funding for the Pentagon and other defense operations in the year ahead. Their omission caused an uproar among some lawmakers, even as others cheered the legislation as comprehensive and historic. The bill next heads to the Senate, where it is expected to pass and move on to the White House for Biden's approval. Perhaps the word uproar in the story was real, or maybe it was performance art, or maybe it was creative license, or a little of all three. But it's often hard, you know, to remember the famous quote from actually Prince Otto von Bismarck. Politics is the art of the possible, the attainable, the art of the next best. And then there's also another famous quote, when you're up to your ass in alligators, it's hard to remember that your initial goal was to drain the swamp. I know that Andrew and I have disagreements in this area, so I'll let him speak for himself.
Yeah, I mean, my disagreements are summed up basically by this is another case of Republicans dictating what's possible, to reference your quote, and Democrats rolling over and going with it.
I think that's debatable, but, you know, that's why there is debate.
That's why there's debate.
Okay, the next story is not new. It's about 3 weeks old, but just in case you missed it, there was a summit between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and in the New York Times, it said that the goal was to avoid thorny questions. The meeting let North American leaders present a united front without going into detail on deeper issues, including trade disputes or migration. So because it's 3 weeks old, I'm not going to go into the story. You can read it if you're interested. Go to thinkwingradio.com for the show post. And Andrew, I believe you'll have some comments posted there as well on the story that you...
Yes, to discuss some of those thorny questions, head to thinkwingradio.com, click on the most recent blog post, and scroll down.
There are a couple of opinion pieces in the New York Times that I thought are worth reading, but that we don't have time to discuss properly, so I'll just mention them. A useful history and geopolitical perspective is called What's Driving Putin's Ukraine Brinkmanship? There are tactical reasons for threatening an invasion, but the real cause may lie in the Kremlin's fixation with righting what it sees as a historical injustice. The other story, also in the New York Times, an opinion piece I thought was interesting, it's a reminder that diseases can change the course of history, although it's too soon to say. It's called The Pandemic is Beating Putin. The stories are interesting. If you either have a subscription or you haven't used up your five stories per month on your, what is the term for that again?
The five free articles, I believe.
Yeah, the
paywall.
Paywall. Thank you. Yeah. You know, going to be 71 in a few weeks, man. Okay. Next story from the BBC.com. The small nuclear power plants billed as an energy fix. This is from November 19th. We'll likely have more accidents than existing reactors because it's a new technology, but these will be accidents and not disasters, says the co-founder of Denmark Seaborg Technologies. His nuclear power company is one of several developing a new generation of small nuclear reactors. Like others in the industry, Mr. Schoenfeld wants to address fears over safety. I have them. In Seaborg's case, their reactors will be housed, this is the good news, on floating barges and use molten salt to moderate reactions. Mr. Schoenfeld argues that this setup and location means large-scale disasters, perhaps caused by a terrorist attack, simply aren't possible. He says if a terrorist bombs the reactor and the salt sprays everywhere, then it solidifies and stays. You go and clean it up, he says. The makers of these smaller reactors also claim that as well as being safer, they will be much less expensive than their larger cousins. That's certainly the hope at Rolls-Royce, which has just received a £210 million grant from the UK government and a large cash injection from a consortium of investors to develop its own modular reactor, small modular reactor, SMR. This means that 90% of a Rolls-Royce SMR power plant could be built or assembled in factory conditions, whereas every large nuclear plant has to be individually examined, approved, etc. Based in California, Radiant Nuclear's ambitious tagline is making nuclear more portable, and it wants to shrink nuclear power plants down even further. It says it's developing a reactor the size of a shipping container that could be easily transported by truck. All these things, I have to say, don't make me feel safer. Going on. The project is still in the very early stages, with the company planning a fueled demonstration in 2026 and units in production by 2028. But Radiant does not see its reactors competing for market share with the big power plants that connect to the energy grid. Instead, it's in direct competition with diesel generators that you'd use for backup power or one you'd use in remote off-grid locations, says the company's chief executive. However, anti-nuclear campaigners are not persuaded or reassured by safety claims coming from new entrants to the nuclear power market. According to Kate Hudson, Director General of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, SMRs will still be vulnerable to nuclear accidents and terror attacks. They risk nuclear proliferation and can produce nuclear waste more than conventional reactors per unit of electricity. Mr. Blake from Rolls-Royce says the process for dealing with nuclear waste is well established. He says, spent fuel is retained at the site and will be processed in the same ways as a standard pressurized water reactor. It will be held at the site and eventually transferred to a geological disposal site facility, perhaps deep underground. The proponents of small nuclear plants say their technology will be necessary to meet an expected doubling of demand for electricity in the UK, in this case from consumers, by 2050. Mm-hmm. You know, I respect the fact that there are people that see nuclear power of some sort as carbon-free, of course, after construction, and necessary to prevent or at least mitigate global warming. I'm just not persuaded by most of these arguments. There may be a way to do it, but to simply fall back on, yeah, we'll store it, that hasn't worked out so well at Fukushima, where they are running out of storage space and they've tried ice walls underground to protect aquifers. and they're filtering out as much radioactivity as they can, but they can't get all of it, and still having to dump radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, I'm just not persuaded. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not totally against nuclear power. I think I'm something of a untypical green in that respect, because the party is known for opposing nuclear power. But I do think that nuclear weapons are encouraged by, you know, commonly available nuclear power. So I don't believe we can rely on nuclear as a source of power until we disarm. I'm also concerned about the waste produced. Yes, we can bury it, but that's not a solution. It's a stopgap. I think I'm echoing some of your sentiments by saying that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really think it should be our main source of energy until we can drastically reduce the waste produced. That was a fun bit of alliteration that I just realized. Plus, I would think that new plants that we build would have the same issue that renewables already have with environmental impact of the building materials, not necessarily running the plant, but, you know, mining the raw precious metals necessary to build the monitoring systems and, you know, the specialized components that go into running any kind of nuclear plant, no matter the size. So
I think to the extent that nuclear is seen as essential, mm-hmm. it boils down to current renewables like solar and wind don't have really cost-effective storage capabilities. Mm-hmm. I think if we can get that problem worked out, I have a feeling that solar and wind might be perfectly adequate.
I think you're right. And, you know, as much as I hate to give the man any credit, we talked, I don't know how many shows ago now, about a story where Tesla and Elon Musk were working on developing larger batteries. And honestly, I think, you know, taking his personality out of the equation, I think the electric vehicle sort of demand and shift that the industry is going towards is going to be the main driver behind increasing battery size, because people will want their electric vehicles to go farther on a single charge. People already want their phones to get, more than a day's worth of power out of a single charge, you know, or to charge
it's
faster.
It's not only about bigger batteries. I mean, there is so much research, little storylets, if I may call them that mm-hmm. that talk about research into denser batteries, safer batteries,
yes.
batteries that can pack more energy into a smaller space and perhaps are both cheaper to make and easier to recycle and better for the environment. Mm. So, I mean, there's a lot of room to go here. And if it follows an electric version of Moore's Law, we could end up being in fine shape. Well, that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT HD2. Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, and all-around friend is Andrew Ferguson. I hope you found the show interesting, and we'll be back next week. Take care.
See you later.
Greetings, KPFT listeners. This is DJ Metalord, host of Sweet Nightmares Radio Show. Sweet Nightmares Radio Show has been supporting the metal underground and everything in between, from the classics to the newest releases, since 1987. You can catch the show every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the FM band. Also, listen to an encore presentation every Saturday. Yes, every Saturday, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the HD2 channel. Sweet Nightmares, only on 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Charles Hightower, host of the R&B Gold Show, 6 p.m. till 8, right here on KPFT, Houston's community station. I'll be moving and grooving with all the good classic soul just for you on KPFT, FM, and FM HD1 Houston.